Hey friends, Peggy Hall back with you from thehealthyamerican.org. You probably know my guest, Leslie Manoukian. She's making headlines as she has been doing over the last several years, defending your rights and your freedom through all of the cooties hogwash, as I call it. And now this landmark health freedom bill that you've been working on for so long was passed in the state of Idaho, creating model legislation for all of us. I'm so grateful to have you here, Leslie, so you can talk all about what you've been doing and what we can do, what we can learn from you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Peggy. It is so fantastic and so exciting that Idaho actually found the purpose, right? Found the mission and the purpose to do this. And it shouldn't be revolutionary. It should be common sense. But it took the last 5 years for us to understand that we needed to actually make this a law. So I'm super excited to be here and have this great conversation with you.
Wonderful. We're going to dive into all of that. Let's set the stage a little bit. You have been working diligently and tirelessly for many years prior to the hogwash that was sloshed all over us in 2020. Just give us a snapshot as to how you started working in defending our freedoms, health freedom in particular.
Yeah. So I used to work on Wall Street. I worked at Goldman Sachs. And then I went to one of our clients, which is a company called Alliance Capital. And I was living in London. So Goldman transferred me to London. I worked there for them for a couple of years. And then I left to go and work for one of my clients. And that client, is Alliance Capital, where I ran the European growth portfolio management business and research businesses for a while. And in my job, I was responsible for interviewing the CEOs of major multinational corporations to determine whether or not Alliance should invest in those companies. And so I used to see the CEOs, the whole management team of these companies twice a year or something, because we were some of the biggest shareholders in the world at that point in time. And so the CEO of one of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world came into my office, and he was coming in along with his chief financial officer, head of R&D, and head of investor relations to reassure us, because we owned about $1 billion of the company's stock. We were some of the biggest shareholders, and the stock was getting crushed in the stock market. It was down, I don't know, 25 or 30% at this point in time. This is like late 1990s, early 2000s in there. And the reason that the stock was getting crushed is because their new blockbuster drug was killing people. So rumors were coming out of the phase three trials, which is the stage of clinical trials right before a company obtains FDA licensure, that people had died. A few people had died on the trial. And they came into the office, and the CEO literally sat down and looked at me across the table, and he said, you know, listen, and there was other portfolio managers, our research analyst, the conference call to New York with all the analysts and managed portfolio managers there. And he looked at me and he said, listen, it's very, very rare. A few people have died. The bad news is the FDA is going to make us put a black box warning on our packaging, which is this little warning sign on the package. The good news is we still think we can do $7 billion in peak sales. And I was like, I mean, literally, I felt like someone had kicked me in the stomach and had the wind knocked out of me. I was just like, oh my gosh. I don't know if anyone else reacted that way, but I sure did. And after that happened, I went into our analyst's office and I'm like, this is wrong. And she kind of looked at me like, yeah, lady, what do you want me to do about it? You know, Peggy, I had never heard someone so just, you know, offhand assess the risk between human life and corporate profits. It was just like, well, you know, I think he thought we would be excited. We'd be reassured, you know, buy the stock, buy more stock. It's wow. Cheap now. And for me, it was just this wake up call that I was playing for the wrong team, that I was using all of my experience, my education. You know, I'd gone to gotten an MBA from one of the best schools in the world, and that I was actually on the wrong team, using all of my gifts and talents from God for not for good. And I couldn't do it anymore. And so it was a massive wake up call. And then I didn't know about it at that point, but I was super sick and having all sorts of issues. And I kept going to the doctor, and the doctor finally said to me, I know you're sick. You know you're sick. I think you should go and see an acupuncturist or a homeopath, because my kind of medicine can't help you. And I was like, okay, well, homeopathy is much more well known and accepted. In fact, there was a big homeopathic hospital in London when I lived there. And so I went to go and see a homeopath. And it was so life-changing that I enrolled in homeopathy school on the weekends. And it was during that time, in fact, during orientation at the very first weekend, that the guy leading the orientation said, oh, over the next 3 years, we're going to learn about all these topics. We're going to learn about the mind-body connection. We're going to learn about obstacles to cure. We're going to learn about vaccine injury. And I literally raised my hand and said, what are you talking about? Vaccines are the greatest invention of mankind. And he kind of shrugged his shoulders and smirked, like, oh, you're so stupid.
Oh my gosh.
And he's like, well, we're going to learn another perspective. And I literally was like, crossed my arms and shook my head, rolled my eyes, and thought to myself, what a nut job. What a wacko, right? But after the class, he handed me a book called Vaccines, Are They Really Safe and Effective? And I went and read that book. And I've never been the same. I literally cried for days because there are 960 footnotes in the back of it documenting vaccine injury. Sorry, V, what do I, what's your word again that you like
Yeah,
to use?
I call it a cocktail, but we can,
Yes, cocktail injury and death.
right.
And so, and I think because of the fact that I'd already had that experience on Wall Street, I knew it was possible because I had a front row seat to how these people think. And so I was like, oh gosh, there are 960 footnotes in the back of this book. And I'll tell you, Peggy, I just felt God, I felt called by God in that moment that one day I was going to have to make a movie on this subject and find out for myself whether or not those that book was accurate. And the result of that was The Greater Good, which was my award-winning documentary on vaccines that came out in 2011.
Well, let's pause just for a second, Leslie, because that is amazing. And I really want to highlight that you came from a perspective that I think a lot of people have, if we can look around at our communities and society and neighborhoods and friends and family, and they have that exact response. Like, of course, this is medicine and this is development and this is something that's good for us. So you went through that and learned, and then you applied that to create this award-winning documentary. I want to make one comment before we came on the air. You said, and we both agree, that it doesn't matter if they're safe and effective. In fact, that's not the issue. And that phrase rankles you like it does me. Where there is risk, there must be choice. And you and I both agree there is always choice and there must be choice. It doesn't matter the product, it doesn't matter the purpose, it doesn't matter the person, the reasoning, any of that. We have that choice and we have that in our existing laws. But you also said before we came on the air, how did that work out for us? So you
Yeah.
created this documentary. How was it received?
Well, it was actually quite amazing because at first we got an incredible review from the Wall Street Journal Online, and we got a great review from the LA Weekly, and I think the LA Times wasn't even that bad. We did our premiere in Los Angeles, and then we went to New York a little bit later because we wanted to be considered for an Oscar, and you have to do a theatrical release in two major markets. And so we did it in LA and then in New York. By the time we got to New York 3 weeks after the LA, they had like kind of, pulled their troops together and they did a massive hit piece on us in the New York Times.
Were
They
you
lied.
living in London at the time still?
I had left and we had moved home to Idaho and we were living in Idaho and we had a young son. And so, but we went to LA for our premiere, then we went to New York for the premiere, and everything was going great. We were getting all these great reviews. And then the New York Times comes out and they literally lied about us. They actually wrote a review that didn't actually have any bearing on the film. I mean, they completely disregarded the opening scenes in the film. And then they said that we had complained about the review when the truth was they had lied. And so this was a massive wake-up call because up until that point, I had my doubts about the New York Times, but I hadn't really seen it personally. I haven't read the New York Times in 14 years because I don't take it seriously. What they did to us and what they did to other people that I know in the cocktail safety awareness movement, it's just, it's trash. It is trash. And so I will never take it seriously again. But so basically, they smeared us and did everything they could to derail it. And, but that said, I went and then traveled all over the nation for the next couple of years promoting the film and appearing at film festivals and things like this and talking to very willing and very engaged audiences. And we won several awards, you know. So we even won an award from the School of Public Health at the University of Alabama, Birmingham.
Wow, that's amazing. So that was in 2011, correct?
Yeah, that was
So
in
you've
2011.
been at this for a long, long time. I mean, we're looking at 15 years, basically.
Well, 25 actually, because I started researching in 2001 is when I started all my research.
25 years. Yeah. And when let's fast forward a little bit. I know there were a lot of issues that were coming up. You know, I'm from California, and the laws that were being imposed and inflicted against the will of the people that caused an exodus. You were saying a lot of people, like Californians, have moved to Idaho. I think that started probably 2016, 17, 18, you know, when the state was really pushing for these requirements for children to attend school. But I want to fast forward a little bit to 2020, 2019, really, because you probably had all of this on the radar, seeing that the public health departments were tracking these cases of this mystery disease. I really wasn't paying any attention. I don't have a TV. I really wasn't following the news, and I couldn't figure out what everybody was alarmed about until the day I went to Trader Joe's and people were in a panic, throwing everything they could find in their grocery cart. And I just turned around and left. I thought, I don't know what's going on, but I don't want a part of this. Did you see that coming?
Unfortunately, yes. So I've given a lot of presentations in the last 5 years, 6 years, all about how they had put all the different pieces of the puzzle in place, essentially, in order to pave the way to facilitate an authoritarian response to a, you know, supposed public health emergency. And so if you look back to 2001, 9/11, shortly after 2000, after the Patriot Act was passed, Model State Emergency Health Powers Act legislation was passed, was introduced, and then passed subsequently in something like 40, 43 states in whole or in part. And that legislation accorded extraordinary powers to state health departments and governors in the event of a public health emergency. Seriously.
And
So
that's
that
what we
happened in
saw.
2000, that
Yeah.
was in 01, and then you had the PrEP Act in 05. And then you had the whole, like the IHRs, the International Health Regulations, those were changed in 05. And then you had the swine flu. I was still deeply involved at this point and researching it. You had the whole, what it is, Zika, pure hype. Zika had been endemic for decades in most countries in Central America, without causing a microcephaly, which is shrunken brain. It had nothing to do with that, but it might have had something to do with the introduction of a cocktail in Brazil 11 months before to pregnant women, 11 months before, or actually I think it was just to women. And then a lot of them got pregnant. I don't know if they were actually pregnant when they got the cocktail. And then all these babies were born with, shrunken brains. And, you know, malformed head. So I had been through all of this, watching the hype around swine flu. And then in Idaho, the Department of Health and Welfare started enrolling adults in the cocktail registry, even though against, without their knowledge or consent, in violation of law. There's no law that allowed that to happen. And so then they tried to pass a law to cover themselves. And so I fought against that. That was probably 2010 or something like that. My point being that a lot was going on. And then I don't know if you remember this, but in 2018, there was all this popcorn lung. So I have a son who's 22. So I knew about all this stuff because I was really plugged into that. And a lot of his friends vaped. And so I'm like, why is this happening now when people have been vaping for a long time? And so that was very strange. But then in 2019, the World Health Organization came out with its list of the 10 biggest threats to global health. Did you know about this?
Tell me more.
Amongst the top 10 threats was cocktail hesitancy. That's one of the biggest threats to global health. Seriously.
Critical thinking. Yes, it is. Absolutely. Actually, they're right because we're thinking and we don't want to participate in that. I don't even like that word global health.
No,
You
I know.
know,
It's
we spoke about
ridiculous.
that in at great length. It's so ridiculous.
Yeah. Public health, there is no such thing. I mean, there
Exactly.
is for getting, effluent out of waterways and for cleaning up the streets. There should be no garbage
Right,
or,
public sanitation, basically.
exactly. All the things that saved us in the 20th century. I'm fully on board about all this.
Exactly.
Clean drinking water, refrigerated fresh food. Yes, very, very good. Getting the sewage out of the streets. Fully
Yeah.
on board.
So they came out with this global health threat, and people with thinking brains that were questioning things were on that list of the threats.
And also, there was a supposed measles outbreak in a place in New York in a religious community that went from 2018 until 2019. So then the World Health Organization comes out with this. And then Adam Schiff, Congressman Adam Schiff, takes it upon himself to write to Bezos, Zuckerberg. I forget who the other players were back then because many of them have quit their jobs. Sergey Brin, these guys. So
Oh,
to
right.
Amazon,
Yes.
Google, YouTube, Facebook, everything, asking them to take down any content that conflicted with public health policy, public health perspectives. And so what happened was Amazon took my movie down where it had been for almost 4 years. Yeah. It hadn't hurt anybody in 4 years, but now all of a sudden it was on their, premium free streaming service, and then
Right.
they took it down. And so they did this. They purged books, they purged movies, and our social media accounts went from having big audiences to almost nothing. And so I knew what was going on from the very early days. As soon as I started hearing in 2020 that there was some, new disease coming out of China, my radar was up instantly, and I said to my husband, "Oh my gosh, everything that they've been trying to do and prepping for decades, it's here. They're finally going to do it." And I mean, I was envisioning travel restrictions, contact tracing, and forced cocktails. And he said, "Oh honey, don't be silly. It's not going to get that bad." And I was like, "It's going to get that bad." I
Oh.
really felt it. So that happened in January. I'm hearing about this stuff in January. And I literally cried for the first few months of 2020 because I knew what was happening and I knew what was coming. And I didn't think anybody else did. And I felt like Chicken Little, but the sky really is falling.
Yes.
But that actually prompted me to found Health Freedom Defense Fund. And so that was the whole reason I did it. I just thought, I've got to do something. And I had some people who support me who said, "You should do this. You should start." And so we started doing research and preparing for lawsuits already in the late summer of 2020 so that we could really hit the ground running as soon as they started mandating those cocktails, which of course they did not far off, long after that. So that was the whole impetus. And my goal with Health Freedom Defense Fund was to establish the ethical principle of medical autonomy as a societal norm. I mean, it pains me to say that it's not a societal norm today. I don't know how the US veered so far from its original principles, but it did. And so that was my objective, is to educate people about their rights, meaning our God-given rights to do what we think is best for ourselves from a medical and health standpoint, and then to codify that in law. And so that's been what I've really been working on for the last 5 years.
I want to really highlight that, Leslie. Did you call it medical autonomy? Was that the phrase?
Yeah.
I love it.
Medical freedom, medical autonomy. Yeah,
Okay,
there's some.
I really like that because we hear that, health freedom and that it's such a powerful phrase, and that is your health freedom defense. But I think medical autonomy can actually drill down a little farther from people who have heard this health freedom. They don't want to hear it anymore. They're just kind of deaf to that phrase because they saw some posts on Facebook and they thought people were killing others with their words. I know you took the slings and arrows, and so many of us did. I'm getting PTSD just thinking about that 2020. I was like you, thinking, am I the only one that sees this? How is it that I can look out my window and see my neighbors complying without even questioning, at least question and say, is this something I need to do? Is there authority for this? Is this actually going to help me or is it harming me? And they weren't even questioning. And that to me was the scariest thing. I anticipate and pretty much expect that the government doesn't have my best interests at heart. Governments, by and large, they want to take as much power as they can. But my own individual friends and neighbors, that's where I was just astonished that they could not even begrudgingly go along with it, but like eagerly, like excitedly, they were a part of something. They have a mask on, and suddenly they're a surgeon saving lives, you know, staying home alone together and all that stuff. I'm really getting waves of that nausea again, thinking about it. But I want to talk about this because you said you really want to highlight this medical autonomy needs to be a given. It needs to be a matter of fact, accepted part of our society. And for some reason, for all the reasons you talked about and you've seen over the many years, it has been put into the hands of the government. So I really like medical autonomy. It makes it kind of clinical. You know, it's not like a political standpoint. It's
No.
really matter of fact.
And also, I think it really kind of puts it into sharp relief, this whole idea. I mean, who actually thinks it's their authority or prerogative to tell someone else what medicines to take or use,
It's
what
done.
medical interventions? I'm like, really? You think you have the right to tell me what moral authority, on the basis of what moral authority do you assume that power or authority? It's insane to think that someone else, any other individual, the state, an employer, a business operator, anybody, a venue, has the right to say, cocktail papers, please. I mean, think about that. Or, that you have to cover up your only airways. This is just insanity. And so I thought it makes the most sense to try and put this in a medical, like you said, it's clinical. Clearly, medical decisions are private personal matters that can only be made by ourselves, perhaps in consultation with our trusted advisors,
Yes.
right?
And even then,
And
we have a right to not follow that. A doctor can recommend certain things, but you have a right as the individual to accept that, to reject it, to follow it, to change it. So we have to also take the doctors off the pedestal. It was so troubling to me in England where they made people stand outside and clap
oh.
as a parade of, you know, heroes. Suddenly they're heroes. And my mom was a nurse. I have respect for the medical field in certain ways, but boy, has it gone off the rails here. So let's stick on this, the medical autonomy. That is what you're fighting for. We're going to talk about what's going on and what you accomplished, this amazing landmark case in Idaho. But before we do, I want to talk about how you helped people breathe oxygen on airplanes. I mean, this is like, let's talk about heroes that we should applaud right here in front of us. So many of us, including myself, I mean, I couldn't even step a foot on the airplane before they kicked me off. She's like, w and I'm like, This was before any requirements. Anyway, many people chose to not comply, and others didn't know how to stand up for themselves, or they chose to comply because they wanted to, whatever their choice was. But you stood up for all of us, Leslie. Tell us about this, what you did, how long it took. And you're not an attorney. So did you work with attorneys or did you draft these laws yourself? I'm so curious about that.
Well, I've had a baptism by fire law degree, I think. Our
Same.
attorneys joke, they're like, you should sit for the bar. One of them has said to me, which I think is kind of humorous. I mean, obviously, I couldn't sit for the bar, but let me tell you, I do have a much better understanding and appreciation for the pitfalls of the law today than I ever did before. I had no clue. I'd never been in a lawsuit. I had no idea how it worked. And so I have to say, just as an aside, I think this is an important thing for people to really reflect upon, and that is that we have allowed a cult of the experts to prevail in this country and to take away our power. So we have believed that who are the only people in society that get to walk around with a title in the United States? No one else does. And so, like, they are somehow deified. And I just think this is, I know many, many very, very good doctors, and I respect them and I appreciate them. However, as a whole, they are a problem. They are a serious problem. That paradigm and that industry is literally a shackle that binds. And I think that's really, really dangerous. So that's one thing. So with respect to the whole mask thing, because of having done the movie on cocktails, and because I understood and I had advocated for years about freedom with respect to these things to get rid of, ultimately, we want to get rid of all mandates. But at the very least, we had to start years back on making sure that our exemptions were as sound as possible and as simple as possible. And so what happened was that I understood why we were actually in a good place in this country. So think about what happened in New Zealand or Canada or Australia or Britain during the last 5 years. It was a disaster. And why is that? Well, it's because they did not have the unbelievable gift and foresight of our founders who reserved certain powers to the states. In fact, lots of powers. Anything that is not specifically delegated to the federal government in the Constitution is reserved to the states. And amongst those are the police powers, including health powers. And this is why CDC can make a list of recommendations of cocktails, but cannot mandate anything. And so I, as this whole thing is going on, I just kept talking to the attorneys who were new to this game. I was just educating them about these cocktail issues and exemptions and all the laws. They didn't know. They couldn't believe that there's actually a cocktail court. They couldn't believe that the cocktail manufacturers don't have any liability for their products. They were like, "What are you talking about?" They'd been attorneys for 20 and 30 and 40 years, and they were stunned because they had no idea.
Is this in Idaho, Leslie? Were you working with your state?
I have attorneys in California, Florida, and I had some in Idaho at that
Okay.
time. Yeah. So we do have some still in Idaho. Yeah. So it was, but these are people who are very experienced commercial litigators, super high level litigation experts. That was the thing. And I just believe, Peggy, that God brought them into my life at the end of 2019. And so I started educating them and they couldn't believe what I was telling them. So they would go and look it up and then call me and say, "Oh my gosh, you're right." And I'm like, "I know. I mean, I know. You have to go to this kangaroo cocktail court in order to challenge anything." And they just couldn't believe it. So the point is that they got very fired up about helping and helped me to set up Health Freedom Defense Fund. And then as I was educating them, I kept saying this. So remember, there was no mask mandate until President Biden's first full week in office. In fact, his first full day. So he was inaugurated, and the next day he actually told CDC to begin drafting a rule, and they implemented it within a week. And the thing is, there are all sorts of rules and procedures. There's like the Administrative Procedures Act, which they have to follow, which they didn't do. And I just kept
It's
saying to
the
the attorney,
emergency.
yes. And I kept saying to my attorneys, "Listen, this can't be right. They don't have this power or authority. Please go and look it up." And so they did. And they're like, "You know what? You're right. We think you're right. Let's do this." So we filed in July of 2021 and we challenged CDC's mandate for masks on all airplanes, trains, buses, and in any kind of like a hub, terminal or anything like that. But we didn't request injunctive relief, which means we didn't ask for an expedited process. And that was very deliberate. We thought it would play into our hands if we just quietly filed this lawsuit and let it move through the courts, didn't make a big stink about it or anything. Because one, it would just move through the courts. But two, we thought we probably had time on our side. At some point, people were going to come to their senses, we hoped.
Right.
So that's what happened. By the time the ruling came out in April of 2022, people were starting to look around and say to themselves, "Come on. I mean, what is happening here?" Right? In the summer of 2021, the CDC actually announced that the C cocktail didn't stop transmission or infection. So why were these mandates persisting? And so I think it really helped us, that time factor. And I think it caught DOJ off guard a little bit. And so when we got this ruling, which was just, I mean, it was better than anything we could have expected. I mean, one of the happiest moments in my life. I was just doing backflips, as you
And
can imagine.
many of us. Where did you file that, Leslie? Which court?
Well, we had a bunch of members of ours live in Florida. And so we filed in the Middle District of Florida in federal court.
Great. Okay.
Yeah. So We actually drew the very last judge that Trump appointed in his first term. That's just complete luck. There's nothing you can do about that. And she was brave and she got ridiculed for it. There were people, I mean, literally people on criticizing her from the side of the political aisle who thinks that they care the most about people, were criticizing her for being young and pretty.
Stunning.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is
So
shocking.
anyway, it was really quite a sweeping ruling because she upheld every single thing that we claimed and even went a little bit further. She said that even if Congress had delegated this authority to the CDC, it was improper. It was an improper delegation of congressional
Perfect.
authority. So that was huge. So yeah, I mean, and she struck it down instantly. So people were, celebrating
Yes.
mid-flight, right? Pilots were coming on the loudspeaker saying, "Folks,
I
you
know.
take off your masks," and flight attendants were singing and walking down the aisles, holding out garbage bags for people to chuck them into. I mean, it was just like such an extraordinary experience. Yeah.
That is absolutely amazing. So that was 2022. Now, did the Biden administration do any appeal to that, or did they just kind of let it go?
Well, what's really interesting, Peggy, is that it took them a couple days. We're supposedly in a public health emergency, and it took them a couple days. And then they said, "We're deciding whether or not we're going to appeal." They didn't say, "We're going to appeal instantly." Like, literally. So you're in an emergency, and
Right.
these are an emergency measure, and yet you're going to think about it. So, I mean, we had, all this ammo, but they did appeal. And then what happened is, the Biden administration rendered the whole case moot ultimately by rescinding the emergency.
Well, you still won. I
We
mean, you
absolutely won. And
absolutely won.
if a mandate like that is ever implemented again, we can go right back into the court in front of the same judge.
Perfect.
And, I'm pretty confident of where that would come out.
Well, that was a highlight. And I think these wins over time that really helped keep people engaged and buoyant, actually, because part of what these evildoers, the way that they operate is they want to wear us down psychologically, spiritually, emotionally, financially. I mean, these things are very expensive to undertake. So they just want to grind us down. So these wins are very, very important. In fact, I want to go back to your comment about exemptions. That's something that I've been working on for many years. Like you, I just rolled up my sleeves. I dived in. I wanted to learn about these laws to defend my own rights and to help others as well. And I agree with you. We want to never have to use those at all. But there is that kind of safety valve, that emergency hatch escape that we can use in these cases. And I think that it's important also from a legal standpoint, like you educated the attorneys. I think it's important that we are educating our doctors, our children's college, sports teams, our employers, so that they understand that we have rights and there are mechanisms that we can employ to defend those rights. I do understand when people say, "Oh, you shouldn't need an exemption. I don't need an exemption." And I understand where they're coming from, but the fact is that doesn't really work so well when you're taking that approach with your employer. I look at it as an educational opportunity. I created little cards in the early days that just said, "These are my rights. You're not qualified as a medical doctor to do any of these things." And it was just an educational tool to hand to people. And I remember in the very, very early days, my husband said, "We got to get out of town. We got to take a trip. You're way too stressed out. What do you mean take a trip? We can't go anywhere and I'm not complying with any of this." And he said, "That's exactly what they want. They want us to stay home, to not live our lives. And we are going to take a little road trip." And we went up to Big Bear and stayed in a cabin for a couple nights. Well, on that trip, I had my little cards and we had to get gas and I wanted to use the restroom. And I walk in, this is like May of 2020 in California, where the governor had instituted these illegal requirements. And the young girl at the checkout counter said, "Oh, excuse me, excuse me." And I said, "I'm just using the restroom." And she said, "You have to wear a mask." And I gave her the little card. I said, "Would you please read this to me? I forgot my glasses. That was one of my techniques." And she read it out loud. And she got to about the third point, and tears started welling up in her eyes. And she said, I knew this wasn't right that my employer's making me do this. I knew it wasn't right that he's making me tell people they can't come in here unless they have covered their face. I said, please give this to your employer. There's no law that requires him to do this. If people want to do it, they can. But if people don't want to do it, we don't have to. And that gave me hope that we need to educate people. So, anything more you want to say about the exemptions and why that is a useful tool on this path?
Yeah, so I think that, it would be wonderful if everyone just acknowledged that we have rights, but we're not there. And it's going to take time to get us back to the point where we all understand that each and every one of us is responsible for ourselves, for our medical choices, and for our own health and well-being, and that no one else should be able to intrude into that, and no one else can. But in the meantime, we have to use whatever options are available to us in order to protect ourselves. And so, I mean, my father, he was 82 at the time, little man, elderly, heart condition, goes into the grocery store without a mask, even though there was a law where I live. They actually did pass laws. Our local city councils actually passed
Unbelievable. In
laws, Peggy.
Idaho, this is
Yes. Because I live in the People's Republic of Blaine. And so all the towns here, they went along with it. And I sued. Actually, we lost because at that time, our health districts could do all things. Literally, that's what the statute said, all things. So we just took that away this last session, legislative session that just ended a couple weeks ago. But my father, he said, I have an exemption to this big guy, 6 foot 3 guy. He's like, you can't be in here without a mask. He's like, well, I have an exemption. The law says that if you have an exemption, then you're exempt. If you have a medical condition, you can be exempt. And I mean, a heart condition, you don't want to reduce your flow of oxygen when you've got a heart condition already. And he said, we don't care about your exemption. And escorted my little 82-year-old dad out of the grocery store. And I thought, man, I'm going to fight this till the end.
Perfect.
And so, yes, it's very important that you have exemptions in the meantime until we completely right this ship. And it shouldn't be that way, but it is. And so, we have to deal with where we are.
Well, I can see why you were so motivated. That's just horrible the way your dad was treated. And so many people have similar stories where basically they're dealing with criminals who didn't care and they just violated their rights. They discriminated against them. And there are still active lawsuits now, as you know, that are where people are standing up for themselves. Let's fast forward now,
Can I just say
2025.
one thing on
Oh, of
that?
course.
We have one of the biggest lawsuits in the nation still against the Los Angeles Unified School District,
Let's talk
which
about
had
that.
a C cocktail mandate in place until September of 2023, when they finally rescinded it after they got ridiculed in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals by the judges. It was unbelievable. We just had oral argument in March in an en banc hearing, which means in front of 11 judges, and it went very well for us again. And that case will hopefully put a dent in Jacobson, the Supreme Court case from 1905 used to justify cocktail mandates for 120 years, or potentially get rid of it. That's what I really hope for. So my point is that, I think we have to do two things. We have to, well, many things, but my mission is to work at the federal level as much as I have to, filing lawsuits, educating, and all these things, but also work at the local level in order to really clip the power of these entitled bureaucrats who think that they have the power to do all this stuff to people. They are evil. It's pure evil. I mean, Jackie Goldberg, who was the president of the board of the Los Angeles Unified School District, she actually said when they rescinded the mandate, I think it was September 27th of 2023, she's like, we did nothing wrong. She's in a mask, sitting at her desk. We did nothing wrong. I would do it all again. I'm voting this way reluctantly. Well, she just told the court that the only reason that they are rescinding the mandate is because they want to evade judicial review. So she just dug her own grave with that. And I was like, thank you, Ms. Goldberg. My point is that there are many avenues that we can pursue, and we must pursue them all, I guess is what I would say.
Well, that's why I call them public serpents because they are serving evil and the lawfare and the legalistic hijinks that they contort themselves into, you know, ruling these things moot, like, oh, no. Oh, well, no, that ruling doesn't apply because we canceled the emergency. The same thing with the Orange County Board of Supervisors. I was involved in a very simple writ of mandate, using the word mandate, to just have them hold the public meeting, which they're required to do. And they did all of their shenanigans to pretend that they held the public meeting in private, is what they said. Yeah, okay, that's another violation of another law. And then they ran out the clock until the rotating circus of judges who were tossing the case around like a hot potato. Nobody wanted to rule on it until they ran off the clock and said, oh, well, the emergency's over, so it's moot. We don't have to go on.